Good afternoon, everyone. This is the Senate Committee on Health Care. It is February 9th, and we'll need a quorum before we can pass any committee measures out. So let us open a public hearing on Senate Bill 152. Zena?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senate Bill 152 expands authority for practicing optometrists to prescribe Schedule II hydroquinone combination drugs. There's a dash one amendment which adds an emergency clause. There's no revenue impact and a minimal fiscal impact.
Great. We have Bill Cross, Nicole Rush, and Scott Walters.
Madam Chair, committee members, my name is Bill Cross, and I'm here on behalf of the Oregon Optometric Physicians Association. And I would like to introduce Nicole Rush, who's our advocacy committee chair, and Scott Walters, who is our one of our past presidents, and they will review the issue with you.
Madam Chair and members of the Senate Healthcare Committee, my name is Nicole Rush. I am an optometric physician from Bandon, Oregon. I am here representing the Oregon Optometric Physicians Association in support of Senate Bill 152 to ensure that hydrocodone combination medications can once again be prescribed by optometric physicians for our patients. Hydrocodone was recently rescheduled at the federal level from a Schedule III narcotic to a Schedule II. It's a more restrictive class. Hydrocodone combination drugs for ocular pain management have been part of our scope of practice since the formulary was introduced in 2002. The original formulary committee was comprised of two ophthalmologists, two optometrists, and a pharmacist. I understand and agree with the goal of the DEA that was set forth in October of 2014. Hydrocodone is the most widely prescribed and abused painkiller in the United States. However, there have been no reported abuses by optometric physicians in Oregon or in the nation, as our profession only prescribes these medications on rare occasions, in small quantities, and with no refills. If you've ever scratched your eye, you know that we're doing a huge disservice to our patients by not giving access to pain medication. I live in a town of approximately 4,000 people and have a satellite clinic in another town of about 6,000 people. From either place, the closest ophthalmologist is 30 miles away. So my patient, in an immense amount of pain at that point, cannot see to get to another clinic 30 miles away. Even if they have a driver, delaying proper treatment only causes more pain and suffering and an added expense and inconvenience. Optometric physicians do not treat things that are phantom pain, such as headaches or backaches. We only treat things that we can actually see and diagnose. Therefore, the Oregon Optometric Physicians Association is asking for your support in Senate Bill 152, which will simply just reauthorize us to continue to use hydrocodone combination products as we've been doing safely and responsibly for many years.
Thank you very much.
Thanks.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Dr. Scott Walters. I'm from Grants Pass, Oregon. I'm also a past president of the Oregon Board of Optometry. And actually, Dr. Rush covered all of our points. And if you have any questions, we'd be glad to answer them.
The only question I have, do you know anyone who is in opposition to this bill?
Madam Chair, committee members, the only other party that is interested in the bill is the Oregon Academy of Ophthalmology. And I've talked to their lobbyist, who I believe has indicated that they support the bill, and that's the only other organization that I've heard from.
Thank you very much. We will close the public hearing of Senate Bill 152 and open a work session on Senate Bill 152. And Zena, we do have the fiscal and the revenue.
Yes,
Madam Chair, there's no revenue impact and a minimal fiscal impact.
And is there the dash one amendment that adds an emergency clause?
Madam Chair, I move the dash one amendment to Senate Bill 152.
Senator Cruz moves the dash one amendments to Senate Bill 152. Is there any discussion? Is there any opposition? So adopted.
Madam Chair, I move Senate Bill 152 as amended by the dash one amendment to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Cruz moves Senate Bill 152 as amended with the dash ones to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Clerk, call the roll.
Senator Knope.
Excused.
Senator Shields.
Aye.
Senator Steiner Hayward.
Excused.
Vice Chair Cruz.
Aye.
Chair Montes Anderson.
Aye. Motion carries, and Senator Shields, would you carry this bill?
Gladly.
And I will close the work session on Senate Bill 152 and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 279. Zena.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 279 establishes the Oregon Medical Board as a semi-independent state agency. Instructs the board to adopt the budget and to present to the presiding officers. Directs the legislative fiscal officer to submit the board's adopted budget to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means. It abolishes the board account and transfers the balance account to be established by board and appropriated by the board. It creates an effective operative date of July 1st, 2015 and declares an emergency. There's there's a fiscal statement issued and no revenue impact.
Okay. Great. Let's see. Kathleen Haley, and who did you want to come up?
Dr. McKimmy.
Okay.
Good afternoon, Chair Mona Sanderson, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Kathleen Haley, and I serve as the Executive Director for the Oregon Medical Board. With me this afternoon is our Chair Emeritus, Dr. Roger McKimmy, who came up from his clinic duties in Roseburg this afternoon. I have submitted testimony, which is available on OLIS. Senate Bill 279 is the result of a collaborative effort with the Oregon Medical Association and our other professional stakeholders, and it transitions the board to a semi-independent model. And what this model offers us is increased efficiency and a reduction in our expenses. But it also maintains oversight and accountability for the board, both with the legislature, the governor, and the public. Let me begin with the legislative accountability. This is a little bit different than the other semi-independent agencies in that, in addition to having a hearing on our budget and having it posted on our website, there would also be the opportunity for the Ways and Means Committee to call us in for a hearing should there be any questions about the budget, the fees, or other charges that the board puts forward. This is, as I said, in addition to the existing oversight around transparency. The primary feature of the bill really shortens the budget process from 18 months to 6 months, which, given that we are primarily funded by license fees, it would make more sense for us to spend less time and resources on the budget. In addition, it allows us to purchase off the state contracts. So, for example, when we were going to buy computers for our board members to use at our meetings, we could have saved about $100 per computer. That's just one example of the potential savings that the board would have. Everything else remains the same in terms of the board being a state agency. We would still use the Attorney General's office. Our staff are still state employees, and we would be following all of the other DAS policies. Dr. McKimmy is here to talk about the board's perspective on this issue, and either of us would be very happy to answer any questions. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Mona Sanderson, members of the committee, and senators. Appreciate the opportunity to come up and speak to you today. I'm a physician surgeon specializing in urology, practicing in Eugene Springfield, and as our executive director mentioned, a satellite clinic down in Roseburg. And I'd like to speak to you today from the perspective both as a board member. It's been my privilege to serve on the medical board for the past 5 years. I finished my term as chair of that body a year and a half ago, and also as a practicing physician in this state. I hold very near and dear to my heart the missions of the board, which are to preserve the safety of the citizens of our state and healthcare environments, but also to promote physician wellness and to preserve accessibility of the citizens of our state. And I take that mission of the board very seriously. I see Senate Bill 279 as an opportunity to further that mission and to do so efficiently. I do not believe that this bill obviates or secedes any of the legislative accountability that exists before the state legislature. What it does do, as our executive director mentioned, is it promotes some efficiencies in acquisition of goods in ways that will permit us to hold the line on licensure fees, which I think is...
We forgot to have you introduce yourself for our committee staff. So just state your name for the record.
Certainly. I'm Roger McKimmy. I'm a physician and surgeon for...
Thank you. Thank you.
And former chair of the board.
Thank you. Go ahead.
Certainly. In any case, I see this bill as advantageous for all the stakeholders that participate in physician wellness, in patient wellness, and in the mission of the medical board. And I do hope that the Senate will and this committee will give it due consideration. I'd be happy to answer any questions that you have.
I've already talked to Ms. Haley about this. Physician assistants are very important to me. It really has nothing to do with the mission of this bill or the goal of this bill. But I have always felt that PAs, we have two members of the public on the board. We have, there's a podiatrist on the board, but we don't have a PA, a physician assistant on the board. And especially if there's not going to be the stringent legislative oversight. And I know you have a subcommittee of six members for PAs, but I would really like to see having a PA added to the board. I don't know if now is the time to do that, but it's to me, it's like taxation without representation in sense. They, although I know their fees aren't high compared to a lot of licensed professionals, but I would like to know if when a PA, there's complaints on a PA, the board will be making decisions on the PA without really a PA being who understands their role, is they are not going to be on the board. So can you let us know why the board consistently doesn't want to have PAs on the board?
May I speak to that?
Sure.
Chairman Anderson, I also served as chair of the investigative committee in which occasionally physician's assistants would be before the board. And in fact, the board does involve, in any disciplinary matter involving a physician's assistant, one of the members of the PA advisory committee. And so we have been, the investigative committee has been the beneficiary of input from a physician's assistant who is a member of the advisory committee of the board. As to the makeup of the board itself, and please correct me if I'm wrong, I think it is a separate issue from Senate Bill 279. But if I'm not mistaken, it's determined by statute. And again, during my time on the board has enjoyed a very collaborative relationship with the Oregon Physicians Assistant Society, and will continue to do so.
The reason I bring it up, I'm a nurse, and the nursing board, you know, has a CNA, has a nurse practitioner, has a nurse, forget. And I wish that the medical board would sort of change the culture and start thinking about being more inclusive of the people that their licenses fall under your board. I'm putting that on the record. I'm not sure we're going to come forward with an amendment or anything because the relating to clause is open to doing something like that. I'd have to see, but I needed to get this on the record because I think it is an issue, an important issue to me and I think to many PAs. All right. I've had my say. Any other say? Okay. All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And I'm going to call up three people, Eric Dover, Christian Wolf, and Ken Welker. Would you please come forward?
We'd like to let the Ogles go first because they have two young children.
Okay. Yes, David. I've met you before. Hi, David. David Ogle, Sarah Ogle, and your family.
Well,
So, baby.
Senator Bates, do you want to put your comments on the record first?
No, I'll let them go first.
Okay, thank you.
My wife is going to go first.
Hello. My name is Sarah Ogle. I'm the wife of Dr. David Ogle. I just have a little testimony I wanted to read to you here. My husband's medical license was unjustly revoked by the Oregon Medical Board in April 2010, and now we learn of their proposal for more power. OMB already has very minimal oversight and does whatever it pleases. Although it may be too late to reverse the harm done to our young family, I felt it my public duty to inform you about my experience with OMB and the Oregon Department of Justice. My husband's appeal was denied by the United States Court of Appeals for the Ninth Circuit last year. There appears to be no way of correcting this harm done here in Oregon by the medical board. However, you need to vote no on Senate Bill 279. We have found no justice in the state of Oregon after exhausting our legal remedies and now experience the full weight of the injustice and grievous harm inflicted by OMB. My husband has fought hard and sacrificed himself and our family to fight this battle. It has inflicted wounds that only God can heal. In December 2005, I went to work as a receptionist in the medical office of the kind, honest, and loving man who would become my husband. We recognized early in the course of our employer-employee relationship that we wanted to consider more than just friendship in the future by way of a traditional courtship when the time was right. I had grown up in a family that recognized Christian values, so I honored tradition by avoiding any dating until my family recognized and approved. Dr. Ogle became a friend of my family, as he had with many of his patients in a small Oregon town known as Sweet Elm. Although he was never considered my primary physician, I sought his advice on several occasions concerning alternative therapies such as a vitamin mineral IV, which I received one time and quickly recovered from a flu-like illness. During the time that I was a healthcare staff member of Dr. Ogle, he always conducted himself with the utmost respect and trust necessary in a professional relationship. In the ensuing months after my initial employment, Dr. Ogle informed his patients as well as me that he intended to close his practice in Sweet Elm, Oregon, in order to dedicate his full time to his second practice in Portland. We enjoyed our friendship and working together and considered the idea of dating after he closed his practice. We had communicated through email over many months, but never exceeded beyond the words of spiritual affection which we expressed in our personal emails. In July 2006, Dr. Ogle closed his Sweet Elm office in order to dedicate full time to his practice in Portland. However, when my family became aware of our intention to remain friends and start courting, they actively disapproved, such that I was forced to move out of my home for fear of my safety. I moved to Portland, where I found employment in a medical office and began living on my own in Hillsboro. Despite the sadness we both felt for my family's disapproval, David and I started dating. At Thanksgiving in November 2006, David proposed and I accepted. We married in January 2007. Despite invitations to the wedding, my mother and stepfather did not attend. It was a joyous day, yet sad in reference to my family. Life continued for David and me as newlyweds, and all things considered, we were happy and thinking about starting a family. His medical practice in Portland was growing in a new location and building. In spite of the estrangement of my family, I was attempted to maintain contact with them. I had no idea at that time they were being coerced by the Oregon Medical Board with the intention of depriving David of his medical license and my happiness. The Oregon Medical Board coerced and pressured my family to file a complaint and provide stolen emails between my husband and me before we were married. These personal emails were taken by a family member without permission. They simply and innocently displayed our private affections. Thus, Oregon Medical Board violated our constitutional rights in their zealous pursuit to deprive him of his medical property. The Oregon Medical Board actively carried out a vendetta to deprive David of his medical license property since late 2003 due to his practice of family medicine with alternative and nutritional approaches. And finally had obtained the complaint they believed they could use to fabricate their case of deprivation of his medical profession, medical license, medical property, and livelihood, all under the color of law by utilizing State of Oregon administrative law with impunity. The Oregon Medical Board, the state, and all its judges advocate they are immune under the law, which is in distinct contradiction to the intent of the framers of our Constitution of the United States of America. All this has taken a toll on our young marriage. The Oregon Medical Board alleged sexual misconduct, unprofessional and dishonorable conduct where there was none. They accused him of allowing an assistant to practice medicine by permitting the use of applied kinesiology along with provocative neutralization practices that are common in clinics across the United States and recognized increasingly for reimbursement by insurance companies across America. During the administrative law process that masqueraded as a quote, trial, the assistant attorney general demeaned my character as naive and immature and maintained that I was incompetent in my decision processes at the time of my relationship with David, despite evidence to the contrary that we were happily married. Furthermore, neither the Oregon Medical Board nor any attorneys warned or informed David of the dire consequences of deprivation of his medical license, all under the color of law. Even the lady administrative law judge disagreed in her opinion and findings, and her recommendation for only a 6-month suspension was rejected by the Oregon Medical Board. The whole process was a farce. And to add further insult, the Oregon Medical Board filed with Oregon Department of Revenue to come after us for the bill of cost, $34,844.94, for the misery they perpetrated upon us. I can't express the emotional and financial harm that the Oregon Medical Board's action has wreaked upon our family, and most of it brought about after we are happily married and through the means of a violation of our God-given and United States constitutional rights, nor be deprived of life, liberty, or property without the due process of law. The Oregon Appellate Court failed to even write an opinion in their 3-judge panel decision to inform the Oregon Medical Board's decision to destroy my husband's livelihood, career, and good reputation. I can still recall the Oregon Assistant Attorney General's arrogance as she stated in her answer to David's brief that, quote, he received all the process he was due, end of quote. We have talked more than once with our state representative and state senator. Neither of them showed any concern or interest in raising the issue in Salem concerning the aggressive, oppressive, destructive, and repugnant behavior of the Oregon Medical Board. We continue to suffer grievous harm and injustice. David has never even had a malpractice suit in over 20 years in the medical field. In fact, upon first meeting our state senator, who is also the chairman of the healthcare committee, she asked sarcastically, quote, whom did you kill? End of quote. In closing, I am urging you to vote against Senate Bill 279. Many folks wonder why doctors are leaving the profession. My husband wants to work again and contribute his God-given talents and pay taxes without the harm and destruction that has been imposed upon him by the government, both state of Oregon and federal, which backs up everything the state did in this case, such that David cannot work as a physician anywhere in America or the territories. We need your help. Is this the American dream that can be smashed by a State of Oregon Medical Board run amok? I hope you will understand what a nightmare this has been for a woman, mother, and wife. Can you imagine in America, where women have long fought to be treated as equals, that after all I was finally able to assert my independence and date a man for the first time, it was only to have my independence and freedom attacked by a state agency that has stepped in and taken over the place of my abusive stepfather and family? Can you imagine as a woman in America where women are given a voice and allowed to stand up for themselves, that a state agency would not interview the patient referenced in its case, assume that because she is young, she must be naive, and degrade and demean her in order to accomplish their agenda? Can you imagine as a woman in America where we have long fought to protect our rights and freedom, that a state agency would use stolen private communications to base its case upon and display these on their website? Thank you for listening to my story. It is painful to have to tell it as it draws forth all the memories of wrongful harm done, which surely no one would wish to befall their worst enemy, let alone those of us here in America who believe in democracy, freedom, and constitutional rights, both God-given and civil.
Dr. Ogle?
Senators, I am testifying today with the hope of exposing the injustice of the Oregon government perpetrated upon me and my family by the Oregon Medical Board. I owe a duty to my former patients, fellow doctors, and my children to raise these issues of injustice which contribute unabated here in Oregon, continue unabated here in Oregon. As legislators of our state, we demand you exercise your legislative duty towards this state's true constituents and deny the passage of SB 279. The need for more power and autonomy to increase their authority is, in my mind, abhorrent. In January of 2014, I provided all Oregon senators a document similar to what I am sharing here today in the hopes that one of them would step forward and show an interest. In that document, I requested a hearing of these issues, which I'm about to once again address here today. None of the senators showed any interest in my case or even acknowledged my request. I previously filed formal complaints and requests for a hearing with Senator Moniz Anderson and Prezansky and the respective committees they chaired in September 2010 to no avail. I met with Senator Moniz Anderson several times, including once with my wife Sarah and our daughter in Gresham. Senator Anderson verbalized concern and stated she had heard complaints. She gave us the impression she would do something considering the impact this injustice had on our family. We never heard again. I spoke with Senator Prezansky. All he could recommend was that I exhaust my legal remedies in Oregon and contact the Oregon Bar for counsel. Neither senator offered to present my request to the Oregon Senate, nor was anything further heard from either senator. In October of 2012, there was excitement over Dr. Senators Elizabeth Steiner Hayward and Alan Bates' public meeting with OMB. However, nothing of significance ever emerged except OMB denial and the acquiescence by Bates and Steiner Hayward. Specifically, with respect to my case before the OMB, in 2006, my wife's private emails were hacked, as she mentioned, by one of her relatives and under governmental coercion turned over to OMB. At that time, my wife was my office manager before we got married. Subsequently, the OMB knowingly and willfully used these hacked emails to build their case of revocation against me, which financially harmed me professionally and even economically, even though my wife and I were married with a 13-month-old baby girl, our daughter, Isabella. Pursuant to the aforesaid facts, in April of 2010, OMB revoked my license through a farce judicial process known as administrative law. As a consequence of indifference and ineffective legal counsel by a string of attorneys in Oregon, I appealed to the Oregon Court of Appeals on my own, case number A145526, and filed an opening brief in October of 2010. The Oregon Assistant Attorney representing OMB filed an answer brief January 2011. I immediately filed a reply brief. In April that same year, the three-judge appellate court panel affirmed OMB action without an opinion. They ignored the constitutional legal issues raised by my brief. I then exercise my right to review de novo by the court. In July 2011, these same judges denied my petition for reconsideration without writing a single word. The court had acted with deliberate judicial indifference. At this point, I had exhausted my judicial remedies in the Oregon State Courts regarding this travesty of justice perpetrated upon me by OMB. So, in April of 2012, I filed a federal civil lawsuit complaint. That's a 42 U.S.C. 1983, number 3:12-CV-00571-BR. In the U.S. District Court in Portland, after much scheming by the state and the federal judiciary in Portland, my case got fast-tracked. Astoundingly, a federal magistrate and an Article III judge moved to dismiss my lawsuit in August, ignoring the U.S. Constitution issues raised in the complaint. In October of 2012, I filed an emergency motion with the Ninth Circuit Court to obtain temporary relief from a distraint warrant that the aggressive OMB and the Oregon Department of Revenue, ODER, sought to enforce against me for $34,844.94 for their bill of costs. A stay was granted until April 29, 2013, while we awaited the birth of our second child, Alexandria. The clear intent of this maneuver was to cause further harm to me and my family in an attempt to quash any further legal action on my part. Having been dismissed in the U.S. District Court in Portland, I filed an opening brief, number 12-35705, to the U.S. Court of Appeals.
Dr. Ogle, can you sum up? We really need to focus on the merits of the bill.
Well, the merits are that the bill is essentially granting this board more power when they don't need it, they don't deserve it. The part that I think is most important is that they recognize and fail to recognize that they have an executive director who is long in the tooth and needs to resign, that this board should be reprimanded, the DOJ should be reprimanded, there should be further hearings held, there should be a meaningful due process written into the language, the unconstitutional text of ORS 677. The state should grant and provide injunctive relief for harmed Oregon doctors and families. As I said, Executive Director Haley should resign. She has been there too long and done a lot of damage. I think many of you may recall the scandal over Dr. Philip Albers in 94-95 when the OMB lied to the legislature, to you. And I think you're ignoring some of the history of the legislature in 1983 when Al Welling and Senator Dribbers or Ripper asked for questions about physician revocation in Oregon, and they boasted about how the doctor would be revoked in every state in America. And this would all be published and made available on the internet, and especially true today with the data bank that's operated by the feds under the Department of Health and Human Services that stores action reports against physicians forever. So in summation, this attitude prevailed then and it prevails now. The OMB believes it is and was doing a good job to ensure a physician would probably never work in America. OMB boasts about this in their reports with arrogance, unbecoming to an agency of government supposedly representing all people. This behavior needs to end in Oregon. With the current legislative regime deliberately intending to deprive doctors of the due process of law, no well-informed physician will ever come to practice in Oregon. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Dr. Ogle and Sarah Ogle. You have a beautiful family, and I have the utmost compassion for you and your situation. I met with you several times, Dr. Ogle, and I communicated with the board in trying to see if there was a remedy. We talked with Senator Prozansky regarding legal counsel. There's a separation of powers here from the legislature, so I know that Senator Bates and Steiner Hayward met with the board, and I'm very sorry that the outcome is what it is for you. Thank you for coming. All right, Senator Bates. Might as well have Brian Bollinger come up too.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Alan Bates, State Senator, family physician from Southern Oregon. I'm actually going to testify in favor of this bill, and I'll try to give you some quick points to it and go from there. As you might guess, I have had at times a very stormy relationship with the medical board. I'm not going to make any bones about that. We've been down and talked to them. Senator Steiner Hayward and I went down and had a long discussion with him one afternoon. It was not a pleasant one. However, I think we made some progress from that, and I hope that Senator Steiner Hayward feels the same way that I did, that we did make some progress. Many of us feel that at times the board has overreached itself in dealing with physicians and been unfair to some of them. I'm not going to make any bones about that either. We believe they have turned a corner on this in the last year and a half, have been making better decisions and handling things in a better way. Their primary concern is to protect the public. Their secondary concern, though, is to treat physicians and PAs and podiatrists and acupuncturists in a fair and reasonable way. I think they've started doing that again. And the main reason I believe they've done that is that the members of that board are selected by the governor and confirmed by the Senate. And they had a little trouble last time with confirmation. I think that brought them down to the Capitol, have a discussion with us, and started improving those relationships. All that said, from my point of view, this is really a bill that allows the board to be more efficient. They won't be coming in front of Ways and Means every 2 years to have their budget looked at, which is a perfunctionary issue. We deal with $22 billion budget. This is a non-other or another funds budget. There's no general fund money. This is all from fees from physicians. We spend a day or two on it, which is nothing personal here, but kind of a waste of our time most of the time. We can at any time we want to take a look at it. This bill says we may look at it any time we want to and pull it up. If we think they've been unfair with fees or something else, we can bring them in and have a conversation about it and refuse to confirm the budget. But this is basically moving that budget into almost a consent agenda. We can look at it. If we need to bring them in, we will. But I don't want to spend one or two very precious days in this building anymore looking at a budget which we always rubber stamp through and hardly ever make any changes to. I just don't want to do that anymore. There are some other things that streamline this in here. They have not asked for relief from the DOJ, which I thought they might have done, which they didn't. And they have not changed the basic process of confirmation in the Senate, which is the key to keeping them under control. Because the real issue, when you look at the situation with the medical board and the real things you keep running into for issues, is how they work with physicians who have either gotten themselves in trouble or who they think have gotten themselves in trouble, whether that's the case or not. If you ask most physicians what they think about the medical board and getting a letter from the medical board, they feel like they're looking at an 800-pound gorilla. That's just the way we are. Our license and our reputations are all we have. So improving those relationships, improving how the board works with physicians, I think, is a key thing, but is not really a part of this bill. And that's why I am supporting the bill. I still have concerns on the other side, and I'm sure others will keep working with me to make sure the board treats physicians and others that they have licensure for in a fair and reasonable way.
Thank you, Dr. Ryan.
Thank you. Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Brian Behringer with the Oregon Medical Association. There's a letter from our president to the board in support of the bill on OLIS. I just will make a couple quick comments. We're here to also support Senate Bill 279, and I want to start by thanking the OMB for working with the OMA to ensure that this proposal creates more freedom for the board to operate while retaining a very important legislative oversight. We worked with the board to include a new provision that Director Haley mentioned to the semi-independent statute that allows the legislature to maintain some oversight of the board's budget process. Should the administrative budget hearing process not be sufficient, this provision allows interested parties from the public to appeal to the legislature with concerns about the board's proposed budget, proposed fee increases, or proposed increases to their charges. And we think that that's a good addition to the bill. The Ways and Means Committee could then hold a hearing on the proposed budget and then give the OMB direction as to how they'd like them to act. And we believe that this means maintains important legislative oversight of the board's budget process. We think that this move to semi-independence, we agree with Senator Bates, it should provide the board greater freedom from some of the bureaucratic requirements that are in place for large state agencies and allow the board to have more capacity to deal with the issues facing the profession. We believe that the efficiencies and savings derived from the transition to semi-independence will be used to better deliver services to OMB licensees who currently support the operations of the board with their licensing fees. We look forward to continuing to work with the board on this project and others, and I'll go off script just a little bit to say, too, that as the Medical Association, we are also hearing from a lot of members, and we do that, and we take every member's concern, and we do have those conversations with the board as well. But this is about creating a more efficient board.
Thank you very much. The final three.
Madam Chair, may I just say something quickly?
I don't have, thank you, Madam Chair. I don't have any intention of testifying. I just want to echo what Mr. Behringer and Dr. Senator Bates said. I've had, I don't know, half a dozen conversations at least with Ms. Haley and other people about this bill. I had significant reservations at the beginning. I'm okay with it now. I still have some concerns about PA representation. I know that was brought up before I was able to come in the room. I hope we can think about ways to address that. But I think that this is a very limited step that still gives the legislature significant oversight without tying them up in administrative hassles.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
All right. Eric Dover, Christian Wolf, and Ken Welker.
I brought 10 copies. As requested on the website, if any of you are interested in those, I know you all have them on your computer. I'm kind of a paper guy too myself. If the public would like to have a copy of these, they're more than welcome to it, and I will.
Who wants to start?
I'll start. Okay. I didn't know if Cameron needed to get into position here. Hi, my name, Senators, I appreciate the time you're giving us today to discuss SB 279. My name is Eric Dover, medical doctor, who's been revoked by the Oregon Medical Board. Anyways, I come to express serious concerns regarding SB 279 and the Oregon Medical Board. There's no emergency for the OMB removal from the legislative budget process, but there are urgent concerns regarding the OMB that demand immediate attention. First, SB 279. Under submission of budget, Section 3, Subsection 1A states, the board's budget is not subject to review and approval by the Legislative Assembly or to future modification by the Emergency Board or the Legislative Assembly. So what this implies to me is complete loss of control over the Oregon Medical Board by the government and public. Contrary to what I'm hearing here, I don't agree that they have good enough oversight in regards to the budgetary process. It sounds like it's just a rubber stamping for what Dr. Bates presented. Otherwise, subsection 1B states, the board shall adopt or modify a budget only after a public hearing is held on the budget, and they have to give notice to all holders of the licenses for that board. I'd like to know how much notice will be given. I'd like to know by what method and why just the licensees of the board. I'd like to know where the meeting is going to be held at. If the public disagrees, how is this going to be resolved? I hear that there's an appeal process is what I just heard. What protections will be in place to prevent the Oregon Medical Board retaliating against physicians who are in opposition? Subsection 1C states, that the board shall follow generally accepted accounting principles. Well, I hear about a budget, but I don't see a budget. I want to see what the medical board is going to do for a budget this next year before this comes out of committee. Because I don't believe that they can put a budget together with just fees and fines. They've been relying upon federal and state dollars at this time. I think that they will continue to have to rely upon that without raising fees and raising fines on physicians. I'd also like to know how many, at this time, how many licenses are active in Oregon. And again, what are their expected collections and expenditures? They have decades of information. They've been doing this for decades. They should be able to present me with a piece of paper that shows me exactly what the in and output is going to be. Subsection 1E states, a board may elect to donate all or part of the revenue derived by the board from civil penalties to the general fund. I'd like to know what the dollar amount of physician civil penalties have been over the past 20 years, and I'd also like to know what percentage of those have been donated by the Oregon Medical Board to the general fund. Subsection 2A states, present the budget adopted by the board to the governor, president of the Senate, speaker of the House of Representatives, and the legislative fiscal officer. Do these people have any control over the board budget, the budget for the board? And if not, why is this even being presented to them? Under subsection 2B, or excuse me. Oh, yes, under subsection 2B, it says that the legislative fiscal officer will submit the budget to the Ways and Means Committee. Do these people have oversight? Because it sounds like the only thing that they're going to be looking at is possibly adding amendments to the budget in regards to fee increases or charges, et cetera, in regards to the board being able to function. It's real unclear to me as to what oversight, if any, really exists with SB 279. And then I have some clarification of other concerns. First of all, I'd like to know why Oregon Medical Board members only are allowed to be on there if they're in the Oregon Medical Association, because only names from the Oregon Medical Association are given to the governor to decide who they're going to place on the board. Does it make sense that other physicians that may not agree politically with the Oregon Medical Association or may have practice differently than the Oregon Medical Association, they don't have the benefit or the ability to be on the Oregon Medical Board? So you talked about PAs being representative. How about alternative physicians being representative? That would be nice to see, too. Second, I'd like to know what the process is for them choosing public candidates, because I see a process for the physicians. I see a process for the podiatrists. I see no process at all for the public candidates. And third, what does it mean when it says that the medical board can acquire, hold, own, encumber, issue, replace, deal in, and with, and dispose of real and personal property? That doesn't make sense to me, and I'd like further clarification on that. And fourth thing is, I'd like to know how the Oregon Medical Board sets its fees in the first place. As already been discussed, Senator Steiner and Steiner Hayward and Bates addressed the Oregon Medical Board in October 2012. They both expressed extreme concerns regarding OMB dysfunction and physician mistreatment. It took me 15 months to obtain audio of that meeting without paying a significant sum of money. Finally, we were able to get a bootleg of that, and that has been put up, and there's a link on the very last page of my testimony. There's a direct link to that you can go to. I've sent each of you also to your emails the links that you can just click right to them, and you don't have to type them in at all. But anyways, the Oregon, when they spoke to the Oregon Medical Board, the members of the Oregon Medical Board were extremely defensive. It was agreed the senators would discuss some concerning cases with the board. They would attend an investigative committee meeting, and they would be involved, along with the OMA and OMB, in the resurrection of the OMA PEER, Physician Education Evaluation Remediation Program. Ms. Gwen Dayton, legal counsel for the OMA, stated that the PEER program was dismantled because the OMB ceased referring physicians. By resurrecting the program, physicians would be able to stay in state for remediation. I spoke with Ms. Dayton a year later. She said the program would be operating by fall of 2014. I mailed Senator Bates and Steiner Hayward and emailed every other state senator a letter requesting follow-up on the promises made in October 2012. To date, I've received no response from either senator. See enclosure A, which has that letter. That one is addressed to Ms. Steiner Hayward, or Dr. Steiner Hayward. But it was sent to all of you, including Dr. Bates. They also haven't responded to other physicians and patients that have contacted them. What's worrisome to me is that it may be linked to a fear of retaliation by Ms. Haley, Mr. Foote, our Attorney General, Assistant Attorney General that represents the board,
we really need,
and others.
Dr. Doar, we really need to focus on the merits of the
bill.
Well,
I am focusing on the merits because what I'm trying to show here is that there is problems with the trustworthiness of the Oregon Medical Board.
Yeah, Madam Chair, if I may, please, I'd like to say two things. The first is a question. I'm looking at the 2013-15 legislatively approved budget, Doctor, and it says explicitly that the entire agency budget comes from licensure and registration fee, miscellaneous revenue, including the sales of lists and directories and fines and forfeitures imposed as disciplinary measures. You say that the board is getting general fund and federal funds.
If you look at Dr. Ogle's presentation, he has some attachments, some enclosures, and you'll see a pie of what's going on as far as the Department of Justice and federal and state money. So
yeah, the Department of Justice is an entirely separate agency, and you're absolutely correct. The Department of Justice does get federal funds, but if you're talking explicitly about the medical board, which is what we're talking about today, then their entire budget, as does basically any other licensing board in the state, comes entirely from self-generated funds through licensure and registration fees.
I'd like to see that budget and what's going to look like.
Available online.
I'm not talking about past budgets. I'm looking at the future budget where they're going to be autonomous from the budget process. That's what I'd like to see.
That has been the case for every semi-independent agency, including a range of licensure boards, since we instituted that possibility
in the
1990s.
Senator. I'm just asking that I think we should be able to see that.
It's available online, sir.
No, the one's going to be not the ones that have been done, but the one that is going to be done for the future. Is that going to be look any differently? I'd like to see before you pass this bill along, because it may be different. You may think you have an understanding of it, but I'm not sure that you have a complete understanding of it. And I'd like to finish, if I could, because I have just a little bit more to say.
That's at the chair's discretion.
Please,
I'd like
proceed.
To finish. Okay. I'll go through this a bit more quickly for you. Anyways, as I said, I'm worried about the retaliation, because I fear that Ms. Steiner Hayward, and I fear that Dr. Bates, if you listen to the Oregon Medical Board October 2012 meeting, there's definite fear there. They express at the very beginning. Otherwise, Senator Bates also spoke to the Oregon Medical Association, and he said the Oregon Medical Board was out of control. Now, that's a hell of a statement to make, in my opinion. So if you'd like to see how out of control they are, I've also put onto that one page of links a link to my website. You can get a very detailed examination of what happened in my case. Otherwise, what you're seeing here is you're seeing that the board and Mr. Warren Foote will utilize perjury, bullying, obstruction of discovery, incompetent physicians as experts, withholding information, lying, criminal and ignorant ex-cops as investigators, and security personnel who are violent. And I've attached an enclosure there that I sent a letter to the medical board. I also sent it to the governor, secretary of state. It's now going through a process where it went to an auditor, to the auditor department, and now it's gone back to the governor's office again, because these people are they don't want anyone coming to the public sessions. At this point, there is nobody going to the public sessions to oversee the board and what they're up to, because they've all been forced out of there. I was violently forced up against the wall. If you want to read the specifics of it and see what happened, the letter is there. The other thing is that this board, when you go through administrative law in this state, the board is allowed to use hearsay. No other state medical board is allowed to do that.
And you need to sum up, because
I'm going to. I appreciate it. Otherwise, as far as legal counsel, they have no desire or ability to rectify the problem, because it occurs in the frightening context of license revocation, suspension, or restriction. Therefore, most physicians acquiesce to the Oregon Medical Board and sign a forced confession, not understanding they'll still be reported to the National Practitioner Data Bank and, again, will not be able to practice forever. My experience is not isolated. As you can see, there's other physicians here, and believe me, I can give you a bundle of patients, of physicians. I've spoken to two in just the last 5 days in regards to the abuses that are occurring under the medical board. And if you don't think that that relates to this bill, you're totally incorrect, because you're giving them more autonomy, and they don't deserve more autonomy. They deserve less autonomy. In fact, they deserve to be investigated. Ms. Haley needs to be investigated. Mr. Warren Foote needs to be investigated. The members past and present of that board need to be reprimanded, because they're not upholding their oath. They took an oath to the Constitution for due process, for equal protection of the law, etc. And none of that is occurring. So if you think that somehow that that's going to just flow over to their budget and everything's going to be hunky-dory.
Okay, we need to move to the next speaker now.
I'm still speaking. I'm sorry, I don't mean to be rude.
I know.
But I'm focusing on what's going on here, and I think this is very pertinent as to whether or not you pass this bill.
We need to move to the next speaker.
I'm going to leave you with one last thought, and I'll leave it at that. I also put a group of links to a newspaper, an online newspaper, in Oklahoma. It's called Red Dirt News, and it's regards to what's been happening with the Oklahoma Medical Board. There's now a Senate bill to dissolve that medical board in place. One of the representatives that seems to have the guts and moral character to stand up for the public and for the physicians is asking for the resignation of their medical director and the dissolution, because they had people such as a malpractice lawyer on their board that was attacked.
We're talking about Oregon. I'm sorry.
I know, but this is happening in Oregon. That's what you don't understand. This is happening in Oregon.
Yes. Thank you very much. I appreciate it.
The last thing I put in the folder, just to finish up, I sent a letter to Dr. Judge Mann. And you can read there in great detail
as to
the collusions occurring between the ALJs that come into those hearings and the medical board.
To stop, so stop.
We would like to limit 3 minutes for each of you because we have a big agenda. And I appreciate you submitting your testimony in writing, which is extremely important to us. Who wants to go next?
My name is Christian Wolf. I am not a physician. I'm a licensed psychologist associate, and in the world of psychology, this kind of like a physician's assistant in the world of medicine. And I would like to address the chair and the committee members, and thank you for having us here.
Name again?
Christian Wolf.
Thank you.
I have been, and I'm going to use the word victim here, of disciplinary action by the psychology board. And in doing so and being surprised that this happened to me, I never expected that this would happen. I took great interest in finding out more about it. And in the course of this, I have come into contact with many people who have been disciplined by various boards, and there are great parallels among a number of the different boards. Part of what I've done is to become aware of how many stories there are like this, and how many people have part of their stories, their absolute fear of coming before a body such as this, such as these brave gentlemen and families have been doing today. So you are hearing some stories today that are coming from direct experience. My concerns are more general, and I would like to quickly read from my written testimony. I am against the passage of this bill. My belief is that the Oregon Medical Board already has too much autonomy. They need more oversight, not less. No state agency can simultaneously decrease oversight by the state and retain or increase its legitimate authority to act with authority in the name of the state. Independent clubs and associations, or independent, semi-independent agencies, do not grant or regulate state licenses or the practice of medicine. It is the state which grants and regulates state licenses and the practice of medicine. Independence from state oversight should be understood to be inversely related to the powers of the state. The people should not be blocked from access to ordinary means of holding accountable all those who act in the name of the state. Public access to participation in government should be maximized, not compromised. There's nothing which justifies regarding this bill or the passage of this bill as an emergency. This is an example of the reason OMB should not be granted semi-independence. The irresponsible use of hyperbole poses a threat to the people of the state. Actions of the OMB are far too important to be left to a handful of board members selected from narrow pools of candidates. Governing boards can become rogue when left without check or the specter of oversight and may succumb to agendas and passions of self-interest, neglecting that which is in the best interest of the people of the state. Included in this bill is an emergency clause, and as proposed, it reads, this 2015 act being necessary for the immediate preservation of the public peace, health, and safety, an emergency is declared to exist, and this 2015 act takes effect on the passage. Declaring the passage of this bill an emergency shows OMB's willingness to justify any of its actions as necessary for the immediate preservation of the public peace, health, and safety. When emergencies are declared indiscriminately, the governing body of an agency of the state and the people of the state lose the ability to trust declarations of emergencies. Not all things are emergencies. It is, in fact, a threat to the preservation of the public peace, health, and safety when an agency as important as the OMB can authoritatively declare or even suggest that an emergency exists when, in fact, there is none. One way to retain checks and balances over agencies which need to retain the public trust is to retain control over the agency's purse strings. I object to OMB being able to bypass the monthly deposit of the revenues into the general fund. Senate Bill 279 serves only the interests of the Oregon Medical Board, and the OMB's bid for decreased oversight puts the people of Oregon at medical risk. OMB must have public and legislative oversight in part because such boards are not necessarily comprised of the best and brightest among physicians, nor necessarily the most ethical among our state's citizens. Means of public and legislative redress of poor OMB decisions must remain in place, and these means must remain or become more readily accessible than would be the case if SB 279 were passed. I'm just about finished. Thank you. The Oregon Medical Board's bid for semi-independent status should be, at minimum, denied. And in the alternative, an increase in the oversight of the OMB by the Oregon legislature should be considered by the legislature during the time of the 78th Oregon Legislative Assembly 2015 regular session. Thank you very much for allowing me to speak.
Mr. Walker.
Hello, Madam Senator and other senators here. My name is Kenneth Welker, MD. I am testifying for against Senate Bill 279. I have 7 points, which I will quickly summarize. Number one, Oregon Medical Board needs more supervision than what Senate Bill 279 provides. Number two, the Alternative Medical Practice Act passed by this legislature is systematically ignored by the Oregon Medical Board disciplinary function, documenting the need for more supervision than it has. Number three, the power of this medical board has taken to deny safe, effective alternatives in medical practice is dangerously excessive and needs more oversight, not less. Number four, nothing constitutes any emergency need for the medical board to pursue this proposed legislation. The Oregon Medical Board is already too independent without enough critical oversight to protect qualified alternative medical practitioners from their tyrannical abusive powers. Allowing further autonomy is ludicrous, and it's the wrong direction for needed legislative action. Number five, control of state agencies' purse strings is vital to needed oversight. Semi-independent stature would provide less legislative control and needed oversight for this state agency. Do not allow this bill to see the light of day. Number six, Senate Bill 279 only serves the interests of the Oregon Medical Board. It does not provide for the quality care Oregonians deserve. The current process of board selection, for example, excludes functional medicine practitioners from serving on the Oregon Medical Board. Number seven, the Oregon Medical Board's attempt for semi-independent statute is to be denied. Furthermore, reform of the board's process and oversight must be implemented to this legislative session. You will need to increase your oversight of this state agency, provide rules of conduct consistent with civil law, ignoring the tyrannical administrative law process the OMB is currently conducts itself under. Investigations need to be more transparent. Punitive disciplinary fines and fees should be restricted to proven clinical acts only. Thank you, Senators, for your time. We'll be happy to answer any questions.
Questions for the panel? Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Thank you very much for coming to testify.
Thank you.
With that, I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 279 and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 228. Zena.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 228 specifies that an entity doing business as a tanning facility must register each tanning device that is accessible by an individual who is afforded its use as a conditioned benefit or as part of its membership in exchange for a fee or other compensation with the Oregon Hearth Authority. This bill increases annual registration fee per tanning device, increases the biannual registration fee for X-ray machines, and increases the annual license fees not to exceed $5,000 for a specific license. There's no revenue impact, and there's a fiscal statement issued.
Steve.
Thank you, Chair Monica Anderson and members of the committee. And the testimony was submitted in writing as well, so I know your time is valuable. So if any point you might want me to turn to questions as well, I certainly understand. I'm Steve Wagner of the Oregon Health Authority. I'm the administrator for the Center for Health Protection. Thank you for the opportunity to testify before you today in support of Senate Bill 228, which would increase radiation user registration and licensing fees to sustain current operations through the 2015-2017 biennium. Increased fees will be used to sustain the current service levels and not add additional staff or provide for capital expenditures. The health and safety of every Oregonian is impacted by the positive applications of radiation. Examples include dental x-rays to prevent cavities, gamma knives to treat cancer, gauges containing radioactive materials for food processing, and industrial radiography cameras to ensure the integrity of building steel girders. Senate Bill 228 allows radiation protection services to increase x-ray program user registration fees 25%. For example, a dentist would now pay a $140 biennial fee instead of $112. This would change the tanning program fee cap from $100 per device up to $150, and increase radioactive material licensing fee cap from $3,000 to $5,000. The bill would generate revenue to cover the cost of the program. We require $593,755 in increased fees to help assure the ongoing health and safety of Oregonians. The Radiation Protection Services section of the Public Health Division Center for Health Protection is the state's sole radiation protection agency charged with protecting Oregonians from unnecessary and harmful radiation exposure. This is accomplished by the regulation and inspection of 4,268 facilities, which use approximately 14,000 radiation-producing devices and sources of radiation. RPS public protection and regulatory operations are 100% dependent on user registration fees and licensing fees. No general funds support the program. Oregon's fees are low compared to neighboring states. Proposed X-ray registration fees would still be 50% below the total average fees derived from California, Washington, and Nevada. Its radioactive material licensing fees are more than 50% lower than the Nuclear Regulatory Commission. X-ray and tanning program user fees were last increased in 2007. The last radioactive material licensing fee cap was put in place more than 15 years ago. Radiation user registration and licensing fees have not kept pace with inflation. RPS currently has an 18-member staff. The Conference of Radiation Control Program Directors, criteria for an adequate radiation control program, recommends that Oregon should have a 22-member staff given the number of regulated entities. If fees are not increased, the Radiation Protection Service section will have to reduce services, which will increase the potential for harmful radiation exposure and injury to patients, workers, and the public. It would be necessary to reduce the 18-member staff by 5.7 FTEs by the end of the 2017-2019 biennium. This would effectively eliminate the tanning program regulation and enforcement elements, leaving only a device registry. There would be no enforcement of underage tanning restrictions, an increase in preventable tanning bed burn incidents, and an increase in the risk of melanoma incidents, deadliest form of skin cancer, now the second most common cancer in both males and females age 15 to 29. The X-ray program will have fewer radiation health physicists to complete facility inspections and provide less ongoing radiation safety and education to registrants. The radioactive material licensing program will be in jeopardy of breaching our obligations as a Nuclear Regulatory Commission Organization of Agreement State member. In addition, RPS will have fewer staff to conduct timely radiation incident mitigation, consumer complaint follow-up, less time to train local and state radiologic emergency first responders and receivers, to offer radio analytic laboratory services to test agricultural products, and complete environmental surveillance activities, for example, sampling and testing for possible Fukushima radiation in Oregon seawater and coastal drinking water. SB 228 is essential to ensure the ongoing health and safety of Oregonians. The Public Health Division would be pleased to provide the committee with additional information as needed. Thank you for the opportunity to provide you with this testimony.
Thank you. Any questions? Questions? I think that what you need to do is talk to the individual members so that we have a constitutional problem right now. So that means you need to talk to members of the committee.
Okay.
All right.
Madam Chair, yes. If I could, what would be convincing to some here would probably be if the people who are paying the increase could weigh in and say they're okay with it.
Okay.
That would be very helpful.
I can tell you that we have spoken with OHA and the veterinarians, and they are neutral on this. So I could also hook up.
Yeah.
Okay. And I see a sign from the Hospital Association that is neutral.
Madam Chair. So going along the lines with Senator Cruz, not only do I need to hear from the people who are actually going to pay the fee, I need to hear from those people from my district. Because I have a rule that I won't vote for a tax or fee increase unless I get overwhelming support from the people who are actually going to pay the fee. So I haven't heard from anybody from my district who is interested in seeing this fee increase significantly. So it can't just be somebody who wants to see the fee increased. It has to be somebody who actually pays it. Mm-hmm. So you made a long list of people who, you know, of devices. So I assume that there are people in my district who operate those devices who would be happy to let me know of their support for this.
Okay. Yeah.
And going to Senator Knope's comment, I think my concern is that a lot of the people who would be affected by this fee aren't the people who necessarily have representation in this building. So the hospital associations have 5 or 6 lobbyists, I think, who would work in this building. But I also need to be persuaded that, you know, the smaller MRI shops are also okay with this kind of thing happening.
You got your homework. All right. With that, I'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 228 and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 145 quickly. Who's here for 145? Zena?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 145 defines sole employer as the term used in federal law. There's no revenue impact and minimal fiscal impact.
There is no one here to testify, so I'm closing the public hearing on Senate Bill 145, and hopefully whoever brought this forward would please let the committee administrator know Okay. Now, with that, I would like to open a work session on committee measures. Senator Cruz.
Madam Chair, I move that LC 1523, dated 2/3/15, be introduced as a committee bill.
Senator Cruz moves that LC 1523, dated 2/3/15, be introduced as a committee bill. Is there any discussion? Any opposition? So ordered. Okay, now we'll close the work session. And I'll open an informational meeting on coordinated care organizations. And I would like to call Lori. It doesn't matter which who wants to speak first, but I have Lori Kohner, Jeff Hetherington, and Dr. Christine Seals. And I'm so excited that you're here. It's haven't heard about CCOs and really want to know how you're doing.
That Hetherington guy is never going to leave, is he? Okay. It's been about that long.
Okay, who's going to go first?
Where did you want to?
I think that's a great idea.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Lori Kohner, and I'm Director of Health Analytics at the Oregon Health Authority. I have some slides. I am going to go through a very brief overview of the report that we released in January, which presents it's a mid-year report for 2014 performance data from CCOs, and then I'm going to turn it over to the CCO members who are here to speak. Just to give a quick refresher of the metrics that the Oregon Health Authority reports to the Center for Medicaid and Medicare Services, this report is the first report where we publicly presented the core performance measures. That's a handful of measures, some of which are more population health focused, such as proportion of newborns with low birth weight, tobacco prevalence, obesity rates for the members in the state. So those were presented for the first time. There are no financial incentives or penalties tied to those, but we are required to report them as part of our waiver to CMS. And CMS, for the record, is Center for Medicare and Medicaid Services, and I apologize if I use the acronym without thinking. The state performance measures are a set of 33. The Oregon Health Authority needs to show that these metrics improve over time, or there are some financial penalties to the state. And then the last set are the CCO incentive metrics. These 17 are part of the set of 33, but those are incentive metrics that the CCOs are held accountable to the health authority, and we make payments to the CCOs in June for the year prior using a quality pool methodology. The mid-year performance report was released in January. It's a rolling year for most measures that goes from July 2013 through June 2014. There's a link here. It's extensive, and it's publicly posted on our website for anyone who would like to take a look. And it's the first glimmer of how metrics look for and with an inclusion of the expansion population. And so this would be the Affordable Care Act expansion. This is a graphic that comes from Kaiser Family Foundation, and it shows the types of new members that they were expecting Medicaid programs would be enrolling during the first year of expansion. And indeed, that's what we see. So in just looking at the first half of 2014, we saw that there's proportionally fewer children, more adults, and the adult population that grew the most was age 19 to 35. So many of the new members in Oregon Health Plan are younger adults, and a much higher proportion male than female. One thing that's interesting is that the proportion of members by race, ethnicity did not change substantially. You'll see in 2013, we had about 63% of the members were white, and in 2014, it was more like 59-60. So there was not a big change across the ethnic or race categories. We took a look at some utilization numbers for those new members. We categorized members into three different groups. The first would be this that says pre-2014. That means that they had coverage in 2013 and 2014. The new group, we looked all the way back to 2002. They did not have OHP coverage any time in that period. And then the returning had OHP coverage sometime and then came back in 2014. We took a look at a number of utilization characteristics, and you'll see we were particularly interested in emergency department use, and we found that the new group, those members that had no experience, were less likely to use the emergency room than the members who had been continuously enrolled or those returning. There's a similar pattern for what we call avoidable emergency department visits, which would be things that could be treated in primary care. We're going to be looking more carefully at the full year of data and then trying to understand this pattern, some of which we believe is due to the very proactive work of the CCOs to contact new members right away and enroll them in patient-centered primary care homes where they knew where they can get care rather than going to the emergency department right away. In our mid-year progress, we continue to see emergency department utilization decrease. It's decreased by 21% since 2011. The screening for alcohol and substance misuse improved among all CCOs, all 16, as did electronic health record adoption. And we see across time also that the self-reported health status among adults is improved. So when we ask members about their health status, between 2011 and 2013, they reported being healthier. So here's a graphic that shows the emergency department visit over time, and the dark blue box is the most recent. As you can see, we have a steady decline across time. Here's a graphic on patient-centered primary care home enrollment. For those of you that aren't certain what a patient-centered primary care home is, it's a primary care practice that has a team-based approach and has to be certified through the state by meeting a number of criteria. That enrollment has increased by 55% since 2012, and what's of note in this graphic is the dark blue bars are the enrollment in 2014. And you'll see at the bottom the total number of members enrolled in CCOs. So there was a huge jump in the first quarter, and the CCOs maintained a very high enrollment. There was a dip in the second quarter by the time, and at that time you can see the enrollment had increased by 300,000. And by the third quarter, CCOs had successfully enrolled 80% of their members in patient-centered primary care homes. So this was very exciting news and clearly lots of work, which I'm sure they will share in the next few minutes. So there are a few metrics where we aren't progressing as significantly as we would like. So there's a child and adolescent access to primary care provider measure. It's gone down very slightly, but it's kind of a continual decrease. Also, an engagement phase of alcohol and drug treatment. The initiation phase, we've been improving, but the continuation of that treatment, we have some declines that we will be tracking. And finally, tobacco use prevalence is high amongst OHP members. It's about 37% across the state, and the state average is 16%. So that's an area where there's disproportionate use. Also, for 2015, this year that we've just started, we retired two of the incentive measures. One is early elective delivery. That's because as a state, we've gone from 13% down to 2.5%, and the belief is that there's not any more room for improvement, and that improvement has sustained. And then follow up after medication for ADHD for children. Again, we've reached the benchmark as a state, and the numbers for the CCOs are small, and it's not the most reliable measure. Those we will still need to report to the Fed, to the federal government, but we aren't paying incentives for them. We've added dental sealants for children. That's part of a waiver requirement, and because now the CCOs are held accountable for dental. And we also added effective contraceptive use among women at risk of unintended pregnancy. I guess the only thing that is of note is that the challenge pool metrics, which is the way that we distribute funding, one of the measures the Metrics and Scoring Committee decided to change. They took out patient-centered primary care home enrollment because it was so high amongst all the CCOs and put in developmental screening, partly because they wanted to ensure that there was a child-focused measure in the challenge pool metrics. The next progress report will be published this June 2015. It will be metrics calculated for 2014, and it will also include the quality pool distribution to the CCOs, and we'll have expanded cost and utilization information in that report. And for any questions, here's my contact information. Thank you.
Great. Thank you, Lori.
Here you go.
Good afternoon, members of the committee and Madam Chair. My name is Jeff Hetherington. I'm the president of Family Care. We are located in the Portland Tri-County area and have been active in Medicaid managed care for 30 years now. I want to say one other thing about our history as I go through particularly the mental health integration piece. We integrated mental health in 1996. So we had a leg up in terms of contracting and working with the mental health organizations over the rest of the CCOs when they when we converted over. I would say our history would be fair at best, and we have certainly upped our game in that. What I want to pay attention to is a couple of innovations that we've put together, which we think are going to be sort of blockbusters for us. And the first one is what we've done with integration. There's been a lot of talk about integrating the disciplines in medicine and team-based care, et cetera. And what we looked at was internally, we were still organized like an old insurance company with a claims department, a referral and authorization department, and right down the line where you had to take your pick, and good luck to you if you reached someone who was a real person in the right department who knew how to answer your question. We have developed a new service model. And it's really based on forming relationships directly with patients and providers. We haven't, I haven't come to a good name for this because the acronyms haven't worked yet. But what we have developed and fully implemented now is a team-based insurance service model so that all of the people who are in the team represent customer service, behavioral health, dental health, service coordinators, pharmacy, referral and auth, and so on. That team in our office is assigned to a specified group of providers and the patients who are assigned to them. That's primary care providers. And so what this is sort of is a one-and-done type process where the providers have a team they can call into and get whatever information or issues they have handled by one team completely, and the same with patients who call in, that they, again, reach the same team. We are working with regular face-to-face meetings with the providers and our staff so that the people actually get to know each other, which is a little different than calling into a voice recorder and getting Charlotte or whoever, you know, happens to answer the phone. And so the team really handles almost 100% of all the issues that either the provider or the member in that particular group needs. You'll see on page 2, we sort of have a little graphic at the bottom. We call them ports now. I won't go into the hilarity that entailed. But the type of ports that we've had, we have started to organize them based in different types of either practice groups or other types of groups. And you see, we have family practice ports, we have pediatric ports, we have an obstetrical port. We are starting to form, we have one Asian port now to make those, you know, with the culturally competent areas. We have a port for people who have high addictions problems and so on down the line. You can read that. And we do have a Medicare product, so we have a Medicare port. And with the Medicare, we're actually looking at an end-of-life care type port. It'll be a smaller group, but someone that focuses strictly on that. The nice thing about this is that it's scalable, both demographically, geographically, by product line, by condition, or by risk factor. And so as we, you know, as we develop, we are finding, well, you know, here's a significant population that maybe needs its own attention. And so we you know, carve that group out and make a port specifically for them. And we've found so far that it's worked quite well. Provider outcomes, on page 3, we have improved referral access to all the disciplines, because as our ports get familiar with the kinds of patients that their providers have and what they're looking for, they're much more accessible in terms of knowing exactly, okay, if you need those kind of mental health or behavioral health problems or transportation problems or whatever, you know, we can handle those. And those do vary by the types of ports we have. There's better knowledge of unrelated disciplines because our ports are trained to do that. The continuing relationship, I can't tell you how important that is, because they are calling someone they know and someone they have learned to trust. And, you know, that's a little unusual in the insurance area, but providers are extremely important in terms of, if they're happy, the access is better. And so keeping the providers happy is one of a key outcome we're looking for. What we have seen is a decrease in provider complaints, much improved satisfaction of the providers with our staff. And as this is one of the providers, he says, I have a lot less stress dealing with you guys than I have with other insurers. So I had to put that down. The providers are less stressed, it's a better deal. Now, I listed this as expected client outcomes. And expected is because we don't have had this in place long enough to really get clear outcomes. But the familiarity and relationship with the insurer, we find we're getting an interesting return from clients of thank you notes. And I didn't bring those down. I could provide them, but it's an odd thing for an insurer to get thank you notes. And in 30 years, we haven't had anywhere near this kind of a return. They have PCP access they can depend on. The early and quick access to either a provider or to certain types of care we have found has driven down the use of the emergency department, and it also has driven down the provider shopping. And you can read the rest. In terms of outcomes for us, and I think, you know, that's important because we've built quality relationships with the providers. We get quicker resolution on our side, and on their side, and frankly, that saves everybody time. And it also saves everybody both stress and irritation. We're getting improved and extended access to providers, particularly specialty providers, improved cooperation in achieving quality measures. A lot of the docs see that as paperwork, but they're becoming much more cooperative in that area. So far, better outcomes for our patients. We have improved star ratings on the Medicare side, and an improved reputation with our providers. So that's been helpful. The other thing we have done is we took a good hard look at PCP access, and we did this actually in advance of the onslaught of new ACA members. And that was, I think the numbers surprised everybody, and except for the crashing of everybody's phone system, including ours, in the first couple of days, we did fairly well. But what we have done, if you'll take a look at the slide at the bottom of page 5, if you're not familiar with the RBRVS system, I'll be glad to explain it to you later. But it's a formula times a conversion factor. And you can see that the Medicaid conversion factor is 27, Medicare is around 37. CCO averages between 35 and 40, and that's before savings. And the commercial average is 65. Now, what we did starting 3 years ago now is we continually raised our rates. We raised our conversion factor for primary care up to 50, and then we've taken it up to 65. And the bottom line is because PCP services are based on time, they're not based on procedures. And if you don't pay for the time, you don't get it. And so what we have found is that by paying for these services at the commercial rate, we're actually competing now, and our members are competing for the commercial time slots and not the Medicaid time slots. And that makes a huge difference in terms of the amount of time they spent. The net cost to us has been zero. We've seen a decrease in specialty utilization, testing, and ED utilization. So it didn't cost us anything in the long run to provide these services. We do have, on top of that, we do have the savings pool and the quality measures that still apply to all of our primary care docs. So we've been able to maintain those pools on top of the $65 conversion factor. The
sum up, please. Yes.
Huh?
Sum up.
I will. The ongoing challenges, and we hope that will change under a new administration over at OHA. There is still a lack of information and transparency. The MMIS system is still unreliable, and in the areas that I've listed,
it's a fun
rate development is a problem. Duplicative audits, and no real collaboration. It's wasting everybody's time and money, and we are hopeful that the new director, when she's confirmed, will address those fairly quickly. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. My turn. My name is Christine Seals. I'm a family practice physician. Can you guys hear me?
Mm-hmm.
And I am the medical director of Umpqua Health Alliance and from Douglas County. Senator Cruz. Before I get started, I actually want to say thank you to Lori. Her team has actually done an amazing job, and I don't know if you know how much work it takes to actually create all of the data and to work with the CCOs to create specifications, collect data. They're a team that's actually been very collaborative with the CCOs, and I think they do deserve a little bit of appreciation on that one.
Yeah.
I'd like to thank you guys for the opportunity to give you a little bit of an update as well. Obviously, you don't know me here, but I do have a little bit of a passion, and I have a passion for wellness. It's a passion for healthy people. Being primary care, that is what I do. And I do believe that the CCO structure has improved the health in our community. We have a long ways to go, but you did start to see some data that actually supports that. So far, I think this is a positive thing. I have a question for you. What does dentistry, addiction medicine, and mental health have in common? Before the CCOs, I would have said nothing, although I might have said oral fixation, but I would have said they have nothing in common. But the creation of the CCOs has actually brought some of these entities together. ADAPT, which is our local addiction medicine provider, is actually working with Advantage Dental. So we have now addiction specialists and dentists working together to find ways to intervene with smoking cessation, stopping smoking. So sitting at the in the dental chair, someone who actually might care about their teeth, linking together with that, the fact that smoking might be affecting that, it has an opportunity for the dentist to intervene. That is something new. It's different. It's not something we've really done before. It's Espert in the dental chair. Espert's one of our measures. We have Advantage Dental actually now has 34 clinics that have dentists that are trained in this smoking cessation intervention and are excited about it. On the mental health side, we've actually got mental health providers working with our dental providers to find ways to screen the children for dental decay in the mental health setting. Both of these examples are taking the care to where the patient is. So you've got little kids who are in foster care, they've been traumatized, going to the dentist is another trauma. Having a provider actually just do an exam in their mouth when they're in a comfortable setting means that they can figure out whether or not that child needs to be triaged for much higher care or can actually have preventive care. This is, again, something new. It's very different. It's outside the norm, and we think it's actually making a difference. This, you know, I told you I have a passion for wellness, and I think these are things that actually promote wellness and really make a difference, and it's this collaboration and coordination that that paves the way. The CCOs have allowed us to be creative in how we want to intervene and meet the patient. There is a problem, and I think you mentioned it just a little bit. There is one problem, and I do want to bring that to your attention moving forward, and that is that the current payment structure, the capitation rates to the CCOs, the actuarial sound rates that the CCOs are paid, are based on encounters. They're not based on outcome measures for wellness. So if we base everything on an encounter, these types of structures don't get paid for. In fact, I'm concerned that if we don't find a way to pay the CCOs for this innovative type work, pay for wellness, that we might actually revert back and get a focus on fee-for-service and encounter-based care. So I would ask of you to keep an open mind as legislature comes before you. Look for projects or ways in which you could support solutions. We don't have a solution on the table at the moment, but as solutions are brought before you, that you think about ways to support those.
Just a quick question. How are you dealing with pay parity for nurse practitioners?
For family care, Madam Chair, primary care is the primary care. And that's where I would say 99% of our nurse practitioners are. We pay them all the same.
Okay. Yeah, I'm not sure I have an answer for you. I think we do as well, but I'm not sure I know.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Questions?
Madam Chair, I think it'd be interesting if the CCOs could go back and respond to the professional staff on how they are addressing that issue.
Sure. Absolutely.
And just to be clear, my wife is a nurse practitioner. I want to make sure that that conflict is out there in the public. But I think beyond that, it's a class that we pass some legislation on, and I think we need to know how that's working out in the field.
Great.
Sure. Madam Chair, before they leave as well, something we've been working on and playing with, and for the panels yet to come, I'd kind of like you to take a look and take a read at how you would be impacted if we moved the funding for school-based health clinics and school nurses inside the CCOs. Some are already doing it, I know that. But it's a concept that we're working on, so it'd be nice to get a read on that sort of concept.
So you'd like some feedback?
Yeah.
Madam Chair, Senator Cruz, we do pay for school-based health services. If you define funding beyond that, we'll be glad to have that discussion. But it gets a little bit out of the primary care home concept. And getting all of that information back to a primary care physician, I think, is necessary. But the reality is frankly, a lot of those kids don't have any other primary care than the school.
Well, it is outside of the primary care home, but it is also taking the health care to where the people are.
Yeah,
so,
that's correct.
Okay, yeah. I know none of these things happen easily, but I would like to, we'd like to get some feedback on that concept from everybody. So,
Senator Shields.
Thank you. Lori, would you mind kind of coordinating the CCO's response to that question about the pay parity?
I can do that.
Okay. Great. Thank you very much. And the last three people, Jim Connolly, Janet Meyer, and Dan Stevens.
How do I cue this up, guys? Okay. Thank you. Chair Monis-Anderson, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Janet Meyer, and I am the CEO of HealthShare of Oregon. We are one of the 16 CCOs, and we operate in the Clackamas, Multnomah, and Washington County region. We have about 235,000 enrollees. We've been very busy, and so there's a lot I would like to share, but I was reminded I have 3 minutes. So I'm going to say that dental integration went well. From a mechanical transactional point of view, it was very smooth. We have 9 dental plans. We have more dental plans than any other CCO. I'm not sure that's a record I want to hold forever, but that's where we're at. We do have 2 dental plans on our board, and we have a practicing dentist on our board. So we felt like we were very prepared for dental integration. Having said that, it feels like 2015 is really the year where we talk about transformation across the silos. The first year, I think we were focused on getting them under the tent with us, if you will, and now this is the year where we're really talking about transformation. The dental organizations have been very collaborative with us. We meet monthly with the staff and stakeholders. They advise us on policy. They review a lot of our analysis. We're taking a capacity and access report to our board this month, and the dental plans have been very helpful in explaining the world of dentistry and preventive and restorative. So we appreciate the collaboration we're getting. We've been funding some dental programs, expanding Sealants to Head Start, and offering a free dental clinic in Clackamas County, which seems to have a dental shortage. So we're excited. We feel like this is really the year that we're going to start talking in a different way about the opportunities for dental integration. For mental health, I think I would choose to focus on our support for primary care. We've had 2 projects. One is an addictions educational session that was free CME for a lot of primary care providers. In fact, we sold out. It was free, but we got more than we could handle. And it was really an attempt to help the primary care providers deal with a lot of our clients who have substance use disorders and feel like they needed some upskilling of their from their training. They didn't feel like they had quite what they needed to deal with our population. So that's gone really well, and we're planning our next addictions treatment continuing medical education. The other thing I would focus on is we've launched Project Echo, which some of you may be familiar with. It is also a telementoring program, and this is focused on primary care management of psychiatric medication. The primary care providers find psychiatric medication for the most part to be very complex and very sensitive, and so providing the telementoring opportunity using specialists at OHSU has been really well received. In fact, we have providers participating from Hermiston to Puyallup now in our Project Echo, so it's exciting to see that and give the providers that support. I'm going to wrap it up. I would be happy to take any questions or provide additional information.
Let's hear from the panel. Yeah. There
we go. Just one.
Oh, just one.
Thank you. Chairman Monis-Anderson and members of the committee, my name is Jim Connolly. I'm Senior Vice President of Provider Affairs for Trillium Community Health Plan serving Lane County. I'm here today to share Trillium's oral health integration efforts. Trillium's partnership with the dental care organizations, or DCOs, began in January of 2014 with contracts with Advantage and Willamette. And in April 1st, 2014, Capital and ODS started providing services. Today, through the 4 DCOs, we serve 92,000 members in Lane County. Since the beginning of 2014, each of the 4 DCOs has spent a considerable have had a considerable capital investment in Lane County. Excuse me. Advantage has opened a clinic in Springfield and has expanded other clinics. They've added dentists and support staff, and they've expanded their panel through contracts with private practice dentists. Capital Dental Care has relocated one clinic to a larger space, and they've expanded another clinic. They've added dentists in both, and they have room for more dentists. ODS is opening their second OHP clinic. Their first was here in Salem. Their second is in Eugene on March 16th this year. And Willamette Dental has expanded to a third clinic in Eugene to serve the Oregon Health Plan patients. So each of the four DCOs has made significant capital expenditure, as well as recruited dentists and hired staff, both administrative and clinical staff in Lane County. The DCOs have also been quite responsive. All of them have working arrangements now with our safety net clinic, Whitebird. They've also responded to requests to work with Lane Community College's dental programs. And we've the South Lane school-based children's clinic has had support from the DCOs. With the strong support of the DCOs, Trillium launched a pilot project, a First Tooth pilot project. This First Tooth, in addition to medical offices performing an oral health assessment and applying fluoride, it also gives the practitioner an opportunity to have a discussion with the parent about the child's dental home. Trillium has also added the DCO information to every OHP's member's card, and that's helped the pediatricians as well as the emergency rooms and primary care physicians more easily identify which DCO the patient works with. Lastly, we've been working closely with the four DCOs on the two metrics, in particular the DHS custody metrics, the need for an oral, physical, and behavioral health exam in the first 60 days of custody is a pretty high bar for us to get over, and we're working closely with them to do that. And I think at this point, it's been, I'm very pleased with the way we've worked together successfully at this first stage of the, as you said, the first stage of the integration. I will say that nationally, the complete lack of a fully integrated electronic health record combining physical and oral health will continue to be a barrier in fully integrating oral health. So, thank you.
Thank you for the opportunity, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Dan Stevens. I work as the Chief Operating Officer of Government Lines of Business for Pacific Source Health Plans. And we, since the inception of the CCOs, have operated two different CCOs, one in Central Oregon, which touches down into the northern zip codes in Klamath County, and then in the Columbia Gorge region as well. Yeah, it's funny when you go fifth or sixth, you have to either say, I echo a lot of what's been said, but I'll try to call out some things that are maybe a little bit of a deviation from what's been said. You know, I know the questions were related to how has the early experience gone with integration of DCOs and dental and with mental health and behavioral health. We were a distant second to family care 15 years later, whatever it was. We integrated the behavioral health components just 1 year prior to the CCO coming online. So we've had a couple few years running room with that. Would say that journey's not over yet. This has been echoed from some of the previous comments. Our journey with this integration really started at a governance level. So creating a community governance model that not just met statute for the CCO certification process, but really pulled together an entity that was a local, lifted up a 501c3 entity, populated that with behavioral health providers, county commissioners, certainly hospital and other key stakeholders in the healthcare community, practicing physicians. And our corporate board of directors has actually ceded our governance in the Medicaid line of business to that local entity. So for us, this journey of integration sort of starts at a governance level. We've pulled the dental organizations and the behavioral health substance abuse provider representatives into that governing room. And then it moves on to, let's start planning together. How are we going to do? Is the first year just lights on, doors open? And if so, what are some of the things that we're going to set up as foundational paths to future and more transformation? And then the additional piece there is just now we're operating differently. And so when in relationship to planning together, some of that foundational work is really exciting, and some of these things have been mentioned. Doing a community health improvement plan literally together with dental organizations at the table, mental health and substance abuse providers at the table, has been powerful. And that really, that model is now the blueprint for informing the CCO's strategic plan, its annual work plan, the 10 or 12 priorities that we're really going to draw a line in the sand and say, what are we trying to accomplish together and how are we going to get there? So that's been a significant piece of it. Nobody wants to change their business model overnight, and that is not something that is unique to hospitals, insurance companies, dental organizations, or anybody. So what we have started to do in this planning phase is say, let's all get together and try to ask the question, are we of like mind about our vision? You know, everybody in the healthcare can spell triple aim and even pronounce it. Everybody defines it a little bit differently through their own lens. And so what we've endeavored to do is to pull those historically very separate constituents together and say, if we're going to do integration of care models and fund them differently, we have to think differently about how we plan. So let's actually build a strategic plan around integration at a community. And if we can get that endorsed at a governance level, then the commitment of the governing partners is to go back into each of their respective organizations and say, I now have to get that on the strategic work plan of my home organization. So that's an aspect of this that we've done together. Some of the examples of operating differently are very similar to the pieces that have been raised. Operating and lifting up new school-based health centers. 2 or 3 years ago, we would have put physical health providers in those clinics all day long and said, we're good. The conversation now is, how do we get a community dental hygienist in there? How do we get licensed behavioral health therapists in there? Again, sort of bring the healthcare to those points of access.
Right.
We actually have dental care providers visiting kids at a local substance abuse disorder residential facility, something I never thought I'd see in year one of integration. And this isn't only from just sort of dangling money in front of folks and saying, let's do this on a performance, sort of a performance incentive basis. I think this is the result of being in that governance room together and doing some of that integrated planning together. Some of the other examples I could go on, I'll leave it at that with limited time. I think that if there was one concern, and I would just echo the family practice physician from Douglas County, all of this work takes innovation around how we pay for healthcare. And it looks like this notion that we had when we formed the CCOs that we would really be operating in an environment where we would have flexibility within a global budget that grew at a moderated, sustainable rate. If we're now back into this environment, which was very much the way the rates were set in 2015, to counting widgets and only those encounters count toward next year's rates, it will reverse a lot of this. And so I just would echo the comments around sort of clarifying which environment we're working in so we can keep those partners at the table and really keep this thing moving forward. So thanks for the opportunity.
Well, thank you. It's really important for me to know there's always been a void for dental care to our young people in particular, and the elderly, and then especially mental health. And these are two issues that prevention is the key. And so there's still, I think, a lot that we have to do in the prevention arena. And I'm hoping that we can have some big ideas come out of this session on mental health, which a number of us are talking about. So thank you so much. Do you have
thank you.
Any
thank
comments? Yeah.
I would like from all the players here, every time that we have asked the health authority to come in and explain metrics to us, it has confused the hell out of us. Okay? But it gets to what you're talking about is paying for health care, not paying for widgets, because I think we're still doing a lot of widgets in the metrics. So I would like a read on, number one, are what they asking you for actually relevant to the health care in your community, number one, and number two, any suggestions you could have, because I do think we've gotten back into measuring things rather than outcomes. So any help you guys could give us on that would be most appreciated.
Mm-hmm. Good.
Thank you.
Well, thank you very much. I haven't heard from you in a while, and I guess I've looked at your reports, but it's so much better to hear you talk in person. Is there anything else, Zena, that we have? How about carrying over Senate Bill 145?
That's
if we
a
could
easy one.
Carry
yeah.
over Senate Bill 145, because I think Mr. Holt is usually pretty good, and something must have come up where he couldn't testify on that bill. So, yeah, well, we'll carry it over. All right. With that, we're adjourned. Carry it over. All right. With that, we're adjourned.